Namaste and welcome to a very special episode of the Bharat Varta podcast. Our guest today needs no introduction at all. Professor Meenakshi Jain is a renowned historian and scholar. Meenakshi Ji's books include The Seminal Flight of Rates and Rebirth of Temples, The Battle for Rama, Case of the Temple at Ayodhya, and other seminal works. In 2020, Meenakshi Ji was conferred the Padma Shri for her work in the field of literature and education. Today, we are going to be discussing Meenakshi Ji's latest book, Vasudeva Krishna and Mathura, which examines the antiquity of image worship in India. Its main focus is the Bhagavata religion that evolved around Vasudeva Krishna of the Vrishni clan. And co-hosting this discussion with me is Vivek Khaitan, our resident history enthusiast. So without further ado, welcome to Bharat Varta, ma'am. It's a privilege and honor to host you today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So we have specific questions about the book as well, but I thought we can begin with a couple of general questions. Obviously, the audience will want to know those.
Absolutely.
Things.
Absolutely.
So, ma'am, how has the journey been as a historian over the years? Over the last three decades, you have gone from writing textbooks for NCERT to producing what are seen as the definitive tomes of certain subjects that you've covered, whether it's Ayodhya or Satiprata, so on and so forth. So, yeah, would love to understand your experience.
Yeah, it has been a long journey, but it has been a very instructive journey for me. When I started, I was almost, a minority of one or two people. Because, at that time when I started research, the academia was dominated and controlled by a group of historians, a certain school of historians. And by control, I mean, not only did they dominate the universities, they were the ones who appointed lecturers to universities. They controlled the funding agencies. So if you want to do research, you could not get funding unless you worked on a particular subject which they found okay. And worst was that supposing you managed to somehow produce something which was not to their liking, then they still controlled the publishing houses. So there were so many hurdles. And you became aware of the stranglehold only when you went through the various processes. I mean, I never set out on this path by deliberate design. It was just that, when you go on studying certain aspects of a history, you find that it is not there in the curriculum, it is not the university syllabus, then you start exploring. So by hit and trial, I began this journey. But I have to say that initially, the response to my work was not, very enthusiastic. But over the last decade, and especially the last book, Vasudeva Krishna and Mathura, I am simply overwhelmed by the response. And what I find is that people who are not historians, they also want to know. So this is a new group that has joined this debate. They're not professional historians, but they are starved of information about your culture and heritage. And they are not going to go to the universities or to those professors to learn about their past. And social media, has come as a real boon for them, because now they can learn about facets of history which were not taught to them, which are denied to them, and which they're thirsting to know about. So it has been a long journey. I won't say it has been a very, painless journey, but I never looked upon it as a struggle. I looked upon it as my calling. It was something that I enjoyed doing. Every bit of the journey was a journey of discovery for me. So it was not that I was, under some sense of victimhood or anything, not at all. I enjoyed every bit of the learning. The journey was very, very joyous for me. And I'm overwhelmed at the growing audience for works like mine. I'm not the only one. There is a group which has come up outside the academia, which is presenting a view of history, which is very different from what is still taught in schools and universities.
Right. Yeah. Wonderful to hear that, ma'am. And I can speak for everyone listening that, we are, eternally grateful for, the work that you've produced. Really, it's helped us all understand more about our people and about our culture, and especially in stark contrast to the history textbooks that we get to usually read in school. History writing itself, it evokes such strong opinion, actually. among people. The camp is divided between, you know, whether it should be a retelling of facts or, you know, should there be some scope for narrative in terms of people, character, events, and so on. I would love to get your perspective on that.
You see, till now, except for a brief period when under the first NDA government, the stranglehold of the left on textbooks was broken, but that also only for a year. So you can say that from around 1970, there is one dominant discourse. The discourse has undergone one change in the time of UPA 2. And I'll explain what is that change. But the dominant discourse till NDA 1 was by hardcore leftist historians. And one or two principal objectives of theirs were first to deny a coherent civilization in India in the ancient period. So they actually echoed what the British colonial historians wrote about India. The British colonial historians said that there was never an India before we came. It was divided on caste lines, regional lines, etc., etc. So the Marxist historians wanted to deny the integrity of Indian civilization for the ancient period. Broadly speaking, I'm saying there were other factors also. They emphasized caste divisions, etc. And for the medieval period, their main concern was to whitewash, erase, and hide the role of Islamic iconoclasm in the history of this country. And in the British period, they said that Hindu-Muslim divide was a creation of the British. Now, all these points of view have been challenged and can be challenged and are being challenged. So, I want to talk to you about the medieval period. You know, the policy of the Mughals, I mean, the entire Mughal medieval period, there were so many instances of iconoclasm. The first instance was the great temple of Sun at Multan. You know, the Sun temple at Multan was famous throughout India. And Yuan Sang, who came to India in the 7th century, he actually visited that temple. And he described the image. And he wrote that, you know, kings from all over India used to send offerings to this temple. And people would come in thousands from all over India to pray at this temple. This was, a very, very revered temple. So this was the first temple that was destroyed with the coming of the Arab and Turkish invaders. After that, till the time of Aurangzeb and beyond, I think there were very few rulers who departed from this policy. At some time or the other, they all seem to have indulged in that. So this is one facet of our history. It's a fact that happened. But the point is, you will not find any mention of it or discussion of it in the NCRT textbooks. And the second was the persecution towards religious leaders of the subcontinent. Now, I'll give the example of the Sikh gurus. The Sikh gurus, Nanak from the time of Babur and Guru Gobind Singh in the time of Aurangzeb and Banda Bahadur. So the span of the Sikh gurus was coterminous actually with the span of the Mughal Empire, if we can put it that way. You know, but in the university textbooks, in the university syllabus, the topic for discussion was the teachings of Guru Nanak and Kabir. There was no mention of the policy of Jahangir towards Guru Arjan and Shah Jahan and Aurangzeb. And in fact, the NCRT textbook, it had to mention that Jahangir was responsible for the death of Guru Arjan. So how do they do it? Because they didn't want to talk about persecution of Sikh gurus. So the textbook writer wrote, after the death of Guru Arjan by Jahangir. Now, can any student who has not studied history before ever imagine that this means that the passing away of Guru Arjan because of Jahangir? Death by Jahangir means what? So this was the extent to which they went to hide facts. So, and now the present textbooks, which are still there for the last 15 years, they go one step further. They don't distinguish, they don't give timelines. And they discuss Mahmud Ghaznavi's invasion. They discuss Mahmud Ghaznavi in the same paragraph as Raja Raja Chola. Now, can you imagine? The Cholas were among the great kings of India. And how is an 11 or 12 year old student to know what is the difference between Mahmud Ghaznavi and Chola? If you're not even discussing that they came. So this is the kind, this is the extent to which they went to falsify our past.
Right. So oftentimes the rationale for doing something like that is, you know, falls again in two sort of categories, right? So one is they say that, you know, a certain person was a product of their times, right? I mean, so everybody indulged in looting and plunder and so on. And, you know, these are instances of a particular person doing that. Or they say that, hey, I mean, if we talk about all of these things, it may affect certain relations between, you know, religions or caste or and so on and so forth. So what would you say in response to these two things?
So for the first point that you made, that they were product of their times, that is patently false. They were product of a particular ideology or teaching. Otherwise, how do you explain the destruction of temples today in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Bangladesh? How do you explain the blowing up of the Bamiyan Buddhas? So it's not a product of their time. It is the result of a product of a particular thinking or belief, isn't it? Now, what was the second thing that you asked?
The second was, you know, would it affect, you know, communal harmony today if these facts were brought to light and so on?
No, no. The point is that unless you bring it in the open, we are not saying the people of today are responsible for the sins of the past. Nobody is making that argument. But unless you have an open, honest placement of facts on the table, it's like a sore, you know, a wound that goes on and on festering. It will not heal because you're not allowing it to heal. Only when there's an open discussion, and discussion can be without acrimony, you know. But if your intention is just to hide and pretend it never happened, that is what causes the problem.
Right. I think there should be some kind of a truth and reconciliation
absolutely.
Mission.
Absolutely.
In some sense.
That's, many people have said that, because until they have that and there's an open discussion of these things and acceptance, no closure.
Right. One final question and then we can move on to Vivek. He has specific questions about the book itself. You know, you mentioned about, you know, the cabal and, you know, how it was very difficult to, you know, bring up these facts at your time. I wonder, has it become any better today? Because, you know, I remember the instance of, for example, Vikram Sampath's latest book, which, you know, garnered a lot of controversy, and there was, you know, plenty of things said against him as well. It seems as though, you know, I mean, they still have some kind of a stranglehold on the narrative as such. So has it become simpler today, or has it become easier for people to, you know, talk about the history as, you know, as we see it?
See, as far as the university syllabus is concerned, it remains the same.
Right.
We will now see what the curriculum becomes after the new education policy and the framing of the syllabus. But till now, the syllabus remains the same.
Right.
There is no change in the syllabus. So the students are taught whatever we are protesting against. It continues the same way. Now, as far as Vikram Sampath's book is concerned, why it has raised the hackles of these established historians is because he has documented his work so thoroughly, so effectively, so efficiently that they cannot fault him on ignoring facts. The problem is he brought all facts to the table. He has consulted sources in Marathi, in English, and across. I mean, he has gone to England, looked at the archives there, used the archives here, and the extensive research. It is very difficult to think of a book on this Savarkar which has been as thoroughly researched as Vikram's. Now the thing is that Vikram has not tried to hide any fact, so he has presented the good, the bad, and the indifferent. Everything is placed on the table. Now people are asking, what is the problem with Vikram Sampath's book? The problem is that he has presented Savarkar as he was. Not as, you know, just a black personality, but black, white, gray, as all of us are.
Right.
Now, they're harping on the fact that Savarkar pleaded for clemency from the British. Now, the point is that the jail conditions of Savarkar were so inhuman that which Congress leader was subjected to those kind of jail conditions? The top leaders of the Congress party were always kept in luxurious palaces. Their prison was not kala pani, you know. And if he was pleading, it was a format that many people used, as Vikram has shown. Isn't it? So, to come up with a book with two volumes, that book cannot be surpassed. It is, and it is presenting, it's just not Savarkar. He has presented the entire revolutionary movement, how much he has done. But he is not a part of the university system.
Right.
So that is where they will continue to ignore his work as far as university teaching is concerned. But they may enter into debate with him, but because he has done such extensive research, he cannot be faulted on his research.
Right.
And I've seen some of the debates in which, you know, which are on YouTube, and he has come out as a winner in each debate because he is strong on facts. None of the people who are participating in debates with him have done the kind of research that he has done on Savarkar. They're just harping on the fact that, you know, he pleaded for mercy. So yeah. Then I think Vikram Sampat showed that top leaders of the Communist Party also pleaded for mercy on the same pattern. Yeah. You know, it was a set formula that you plead, you write like this, etc. So that's a very, very strong blow to the left historiography, I must say.
Excellent. Over to you, Vivek.
This is the latest book by Dr. Meenakshi Jain, Vasudev Krishna and Mathura, which talks in detail about the city of Mathura, association of Lord Krishna with that place, and the dispute, rather, as we learn from the book, a manufactured dispute at the Katra Keshav Dev temple. So we'll dive into this book very shortly. Before that, ma'am, I just wanted to ask you one question. So the books that you have written over the last, you know, 15, 20 years,
yes,
are what is called the narrative style of history writing, and which is, you know, accessible to history enthusiasts across. Yes. And this is not just a dry academic
yes.
book.
Yes.
But in terms of how academia treats these kind of books, as we have seen in the past, that there is a certain academic style of history writing which may not be accessible to laymen, but yes. has a lot of weight that it carries in academia. Mm. So how has been the reception to your books, not just this one, but the one on Ayodhya, the one on Sati Pratha, the one on flight of deities from temples in the university system? Has it, is it being taught or it's completely?
No question. Today? Complete silence. They don't acknowledge. And I have deliberately chosen this style, as you said, the narrative style, yeah. because I didn't want to reach the, you know, I knew that door was closed for me. Mm. I wanted what I'm researching to be accessible to the common person. Because as I said, the people who are students of history are not many compared to the wide audience, which goes to different fields for careers and all that, but are still interested in knowing about their past. So I never expected any of my books be introduced in the university. So it's not at all something that I worry about. But I can say that ordinary people, that was my target audience. So many have reached out to me and said they've learned so much about our past. And the Marxist role in distorting our past is something that came as an eye-opener to them, especially on Ayodhya. You know, they lied on oath in court.
Yeah.
And there is no historian, Marxist historian, who went to depose in court, who impressed the court with his or her integrity, honesty, and knowledge of the subject. The court passed severe strictures against each and every one of them. So I think that what can be a bigger comment on your intellectual honesty and professional integrity?
Indeed. I mean, the judicial records on that case is something that everyone should read.
Yes.
The kind of comments that courts have made against some of these people who appeared as witnesses, as experts on the subject,
yes.
is a mockery of the expertise as well as the subject.
Yes.
So
All of them, the courts passed strictures against all of them. Yeah. I've quoted excerpts in my book, you know.
So, coming back to the present book that you have written, so Vasudev Krishna and Mathura, Now, this is a book that in popular understanding would be a book that would illuminate the dispute at Khatra Keshav Dev temple complex in Mathura. However, the 60-70% of the book is actually devoted to tracing the origins of image worship in particular, and in general, and Bhagavata religion in particular, through marshalling, you know, various kinds of sources, archaeological, epigraphic, literary. So just help us understand, ma'am, a little bit about Mathura as a city and the history of Bhagavata religion in India.
The starting point has to be the role of a certain group of left historians. You see, in the nine, for the believers, Vasudev Krishna, his authenticity was never in doubt. They continued to worship him over the centuries, and they continue today. The problem was that in the 20th century, a group of historians started saying that Krishna is a mythological figure, he's a myth. Now, this assertion of theirs was actually just the opposite of what leading Indian historians and Western historians had said in the 19th and early 20th century. You see, these historians, they were studying Indian texts like the Chandogya Upanishad. And in the Chandogya Upanishad, they found the first reference to Devaki Putra Krishna. And this is a specific reference because there is no other Devaki Putra Krishna that we come across in our entire religious journey and philosophical, whatever journey you want to say. So this reference to Devaki Putra Krishna intrigued them. And the Chandogya Upanishad also told us what Devaki Putra Krishna learned from his teacher, whose name is also given.
And Chandogya Upanishad, ma'am, is dated to about 17th century before.
Yes, you are right.
So it's about 2700 years from the present times.
Absolutely. So that is the first reference that we get to Devaki Putra Krishna. Now, Devaki Putra Krishna can only be one person. It cannot be confused with anyone else. And Chandogya Upanishad also tells us who his teacher was and what he learned from his teacher. And surprisingly, the teachings in the Gita are very similar to what Devaki Putra Krishna learned from his teacher. All right. So this is, now if we discuss other literary references, early references to Krishna, Devaki Putra Krishna, then, you know, we have Panini. Panini gives us rules of grammar. And Panini's book, Ashtadhyayi, is the only text of that period which does not have anything added to it or subtracted from it. It is the way Panini wrote it. You know, in the Mahabharata, it's very different from what was originally written. You know, it has expanded over the course of centuries, isn't it? People have added. But Panini, it's as he wrote, it is given. Now, Panini there gives us rules of grammar, as I said. And it's very interesting, he says, he gives an example that when you're mentioning two people together, then the name of the person, the shorter name will come first and the longer name will come second. But he says there is an exception, and that exception is when you refer to Arjun and Vasudev. Arjun will not come first, Vasudev will come first, then Arjun will come. Why? Because Vasudev is the worshipful one. So, you know, the antiquity be much more, but the literary evidence that has survived, that is the important thing. And of course, we have Megasthenes, who tells us, Megasthenes was the Greek ambassador to the court of Chandragupta Maurya. He tells us about Mathura being under the control of the Vrishni family. We'll come to that Mathura later. And last example that I want to give is of Patanjali. Patanjali wrote on Panini. And it's interesting that Patanjali, in his book, mentions five instances connected with the life of Krishna. You know, so he's giving examples, and he gives seven examples related to Krishna's life. that itself shows that, you know, the worship of Krishna was so widespread at that time. We have Chandogya Upanishad, we have Panini, we have Patanjali, we have Megasthenes. And the dating of the Mahabharata, we don't know. The exact dating of the Mahabharata remains an enigma. Yeah. So how far we can go back in time is something that, you know, we cannot answer right now. But these are pieces of evidence which cannot be denied. Now you talked about Mathura. You saw in the Mahabharata, Krishna is associated with Mathura, and it tells them in detail that, you know, how his grandfather Nana was the king, and his mama Kans imprisoned the king, usurped the throne, and how Krishna was born. You know, all that story is there. Now, it is very interesting that one Western scholar about half a century ago did a study on plays on the life of Krishna that were staged in Mathura. His study was, when did Mathura begin to stage plays on the life of Krishna? That's an interesting.
Yeah.
So he said Mathura has been staging plays on the life of Krishna for 2000 years. Imagine, you're talking about the antiquity of Mathura. So 2000 years it has been staging plays on the life of Krishna. And the first inscription that he found, because, you know, when you make claims, you have to substantiate, isn't it? I cannot just say that Mathura has been staging plays on the life of Krishna. What is the proof? So I don't want to go into the details, because that's a very fascinating study. But the first evidence that he comes across is a piece of inscription from Mathura.
Hmm.
And that piece of inscription says that this has been sponsored by a family of actors who act on Vasudev and Sankarshan's life. That is, Sankarshan is his brother.
Balram
or Sankarshan, whatever you want to call it. And they are actors. It specifies that they are skilled in singing also. Because, you know, at that time, you sang and you enacted. So it gives these kind of details. So this is very, very fascinating. And now if you want me to come to the actual details that we have found in Mathura, would you like me to talk about
that? Before that, ma'am, I would want to ask one more question on,
yes, please,
on the development of Bhagavata religion.
Mm-hmm.
So, very, very fascinating account you have given of how the present deity Lord Krishna is actually an amalgam,
yes,
of Vasudeva Krishna, and how he came to be viewed as Vishnu avatar at some point of time,
yes,
and the fusion of popular god Gopala with his imagery.
Yes.
So if you can talk a little bit about that, as to how this came about, and how,
yes,
the cult of Vasudeva Krishna developed as a composite of all of this.
Yes. First of all, we must remember that one of the defining characteristics of Indian culture, and Indian civilization is to amalgamate. It doesn't reject. It appropriates, embraces, whatever you want to say. So in the Vedas, in the Rig Veda, we hear of Vishnu. Isn't it? Vishnu is a god.
Yes.
In the Rig Veda. In the Chandogya Upanishad, we hear of Devaki Putra Krishna.
Yes.
Then we also hear of Narayan. And finally, we hear of Krishna Gopal.
Yeah.
So, over a period of several centuries, Devaki Putra Krishna, he assimilates, absorbs all these forms. And it is interesting that the religion that emerges out of, as a result of this amalgamation, is called Vaishnav after Vishnu, whom it also embraces. So now this, it is very interesting that the form, now today in India, if I ask you, is there any temple, how many temples are there in honor of Vedic Vishnu?
Very few. Very same few. As Rudra, I would also assume, in the case of Shiva.
And how many temples are there of Krishna? They'll be in every locality.
Yes, yeah. Almost
but
every.
But who? Yeah. Isn't it? Every locality. And the most popular festival is Krishna Janmashtami.
Yes.
Now, who is this Krishna? Because Devaki Putra Krishna, we see in the Chandogya Upanishad, is different. So, at some point, there was a tribal community. Not tribal community, I'm sorry. A community of cowherds. Gwalas. And Krishna Gopal was their deity. And it is so interesting that the deity of the cowherd community is elevated to an all-India stature. He is now the most revered form of Vasudev Krishna, and celebrated his birth, all his festivities, they are celebrated with such joy all over the country. So it is a god of the cowherd community getting all India stature. So this is how it comes about. It's a long process. It doesn't happen overnight. But it is a process that we see not just in the case of Vasudev Krishna, but so many other deities in India. You know, they don't exclude. They elevate. You become a part, you become an avatar. All the female goddesses, for example, Uma, Usha, they all become forms of Parvati. You know, at every village, if there's a goddess, they'll say Parvati ka roop hai. Because no form of worship is regarded as low or high. They're all paying homage to a divine energy, and they all regarded as avatars of that divine energy.
Yeah, another charge which is, you know, typically laid at the doors, particularly of Lord Rama and Krishna, is that they are essentially a North India phenomenon. So, given this kind of narrative, which was sought to be propagated earlier, can you tell us a little bit about the spread of Bhagavata religion across India?
I'm so glad that you've asked this question, because it is such an important question. Yeah. You know, we, as you said, it's associated with North India, Bhagavata religion, and particularly with Mathura. So the evidence at Mathura and before Mathura at Vidisha, Besnagar. So the two early inscriptional evidence that we have of Krishna worship are in Besnagar, Vidisha and Mathura. But to answer your question, which is such an important question, in the 2nd century BCE, an inscription was discovered in the Western Ghats called the Nana Ghat inscription. That Nana Ghat inscription, epigraphist Bhula regards it as the most important inscription that has been found in that region. Now, that inscription mentions the name of the family which has sponsored this inscription. And that family says, we have conducted 18 Vedic yagyas. So they are taking pride in the fact that they are following the Vedic yagyas and have conducted 18 yagyas. And that inscription mentions the 18 yagyas that have been conducted by this family. And the inscription begins with homage to Vasudev and Balram. So, in the 2nd century BCE, Krishna worship had already reached the Western Ghats. From there, it went to the Tamil region, and you know the Alvars, the Acharyas, their role, and then it went all over India. But 2nd century BCE, we have epigraphic evidence of Krishna worship crossing the Vindhyas, and we have this inscription of the Western Ghats, which is very, very interesting.
So, ma'am, let's come to around 1000 of Common Era now, at the time when the history of Islamic iconoclasm begins, you know, in India.
Yeah.
Tell us a little about its impact on Mathura.
And the
temple in question specifically.
Yes. Do you want me to first just briefly say what we have found before 1000 BC at Mathura? Before 1000 Common Era? So the earliest, and I want to make this point again and again, that when we talk about inscriptional evidence or architectural evidence at Mathura, we have to remember that Mathura was attacked again and again. Violent attacks it experienced. So no inscription is intact. Very few inscriptions have survived, and very few architectural pieces have survived. But the little fragments that have survived, they help us to reconstruct the story of the temple, because you asked about the temple. So the first inscription that we have is before 15 Common Era. Why do I say 15 Common Era? Because it mentions the name of a ruler whose reign ended in 15 Common Era. So how many years ago is it? More than 2000 years ago?
Yes.
So this inscription, it gives the name of the person. And he says that I'm erecting this structure. And because it's partially damaged, we get parts of that structure that he's constructing. Toran, it mentions Toran. Toran is an arch. And it mentions a rectangle and some buildings around it. But the most important thing it says that I am erecting this structure at the Mahasthan of Vishnu, of Vasudev. Now, what is this Mahasthan? Because the inscription is not complete, we cannot make out why he refers to the word, why he uses the word Mahasthan. But Mahasthan means great place. So it can only be either the birthplace of Krishna or some important event in his life, like the killing of Kans. We cannot say, because as I said, the inscription is not complete. But before 15 Common Era, there is an inscription which talks about Katra Keshav Dev site as the Mahasthan of Vasudev. That's important. And another inscription, Moravel inscription, which was discovered a little later, it talks about a stone structure erected in honor of the five Vrishni heroes, that is Vasudev Krishna, his brother, his son, etc. And you won't believe it, but three torsos were found in that area in 1911, which historians say could be Vasudev, his brother, and his sister. Now, what I want to emphasize is that none of these excavations are the result of any right-wing effort or work. These are excavations that were conducted mostly in the colonial period. And the people who have interpreted the inscriptions and examined the sculptures, they are people of world standing, very reputed people. So we should not try to fudge facts or try to distort the debate by bringing in false, you know, arguments. Now, you said about the history of the invasions. So, as you know, Mathura was first invaded by Mahmud Ghaznavi for 9 days, or not 9 days, in his ninth expedition. And it was very, very badly desecrated and damaged, as recorded by his court historian Utbi. Now, again, the importance of inscriptions. A fragment of an inscription, 1 century after Mahmud Ghaznavi, talks about a temple erected by a person called Jhajja. Now, we have no other evidence of Jhajja from any other source. And if this inscription had not survived, we would not even know that there was a Jhajja who constructed that temple again. So, you know, the inscriptions are patchy, but they are helping us where we have no other evidence. Then that temple of Jhajja, it perhaps was destroyed and repaired.
The meeting of the temple made by Jhajja is early 12th century.
Yes, absolutely. So that temple is destroyed, repaired, rebuilt, whatever. Because Farishta mentions the attacks of Qutbuddin Aibak, it mentions the attack of Firoz Tughlaq, it mentions the attack of Sikandar Lodi. So we don't know whether the temple was fully destroyed and repaired, whatever it was, but these attacks are mentioned. And in the time of Akbar, Father Montserrat, a Portuguese Jesuit, he stayed in Akbar's court for some time, and he came to Mathura and he said that there is no temple standing in Mathura except one. And he describes that temple. Then coming to the time of Jahangir, the temple that was destroyed by Aurangzeb was actually built in the time of Jahangir by the ruler of Orchha, Bir Singh Bundela. It was a magnificent structure. It would be seen miles at a mile's distance, and it was seen by the French traveler Bernier and Tavernier. They have left vivid accounts of the temple which they saw. Now, this temple was destroyed on the orders of Aurangzeb, and we have two eyewitness accounts. One is the Italian traveler Manucci, and the other is a Mughal historian, Saki Mustaid Khan. They describe in detail the destruction of the temple.
And this destruction happened in 1670.
Yes, 1670. Yeah. Absolutely. After that, we know that the Eidgah was constructed at that site. But Mathura, that was not the end of Mathura's problems. Mathura had another attack in 1757 by Ahmad Shah Abdali, which was really horrifying. And that also, the eyewitness account is by a camp follower of his who wrote in Persian. That account was translated in 1901 by William Irwin. So these are all accounts that are there well before the present times. So you know, that factor has to be always kept in mind while discussing and debating this issue. So this is till 1770 ke kareeb, you can say. We are almost there.
So it's a continuous history starting from around 1017 with Mahmud Ghaznavi till 1770.
Yes.
700 years, ruler after ruler, you know, who had foreign origins, Turkish yes. origins, have destroyed, and Hindu, I mean, the community in Mathura has over the period have also built the temple so that it was destroyed again and again.
Yes.
That says something about the history of the belief system which compelled these rulers to indulge in these kind of vandalism.
Can I just add one thing here?
Yes, ma'am.
You know, Aurangzeb, when he was 80 plus, he sent a farman to his officers in Gujarat. And he said that make sure that no terracotta images are being made. You know, and Diwali, we have these terracotta images of gods and all, Lakshmi, and yes. we bring them to our house. Those terracotta images, he sent an order, make sure that no terracotta images of deities are made at the time of their festivities. Mm. And check at Somnath. If the Hindus have again started worshipping at Somnath, destroy that area in such a way that they can never worship again. So this obsession, you know, Rohan, you had asked me, Roshan, you had asked me a question in the beginning, that was it the period of their times? That time doesn't change, you know, that from Mahmud Ghaznavi till Aurangzeb, there is no change in the time, isn't it? So imagine at 80 plus, he's asking his officer to make sure that worship has not resumed in Somnath. Doesn't it tell us something about the ideology at work?
So, so around 1770, the city passes in the hands of Marathas.
Yes.
Who promptly lose it to, you know, British, as British power has yes. really become very powerful around the turn of that century.
Yes.
So what happens then? So once we reach the British times, then what happens to Khatra Keshav Dev at that point?
You see, the British continued the Maratha policy of declaring Khatra Keshav Dev as Nazul or government land. Yeah. Now in 1815, they sell this entire plot of Khatra Keshav Dev. It measured 13.37 acres. They sell it to Raja Patnimal of Banaras. That sale is recorded in the British revenue records and judicial records. So there's no dispute about it. And after Raja Patnimal, his successors, in turn, are registered as the owners of Katra Keshav Dev. So what we have to emphasize is that Katra Keshav Dev is never divided or partitioned. It is one unit. And it is the unit that is sold to Raja Patnimal and his heirs. Now, when that Patnimal, when it is sold to Raja Patnimal and his heirs, the Maulvis of the Eidgah, they come back. When the Marathas established their control on Mathura, the Maulvis had left. They said, now we have, there's no place for us here. We'll go and look for our earning livelihood somewhere else. So they had left the place. Now when Patnimal buys it, then they come back. And they come back and they file a series of cases in the Faizabad district court. In the Mathura district court, saying that this sale is illegal, he is not the owner, whatever it is. And about 10-15 of those cases, I have presented the records in my book. I think this is the first time that people have got to see the proceedings in the British courts between the two parties. Yes. 10-15 cases I have mentioned. And each British judge heard the case very patiently, did a lot of his own investigation, and passed his verdict. Each British judge spoke against the Eidgah party and said, you have no case whatever. You have not been able to produce a single document to make your case. All the revenue records, judicial records, everything is in favor of Patnimal and his heirs. So, in spite of suffering one loss after another in the British courts, the Eidgah party went on filing, but till the time of independence, they could not win a single case. Now, I just want to quickly just, what for our purposes, what is important is that Raja Patnimal and his family, rather, they were under some debt and they were unable to pay that debt. It was a small amount by today's standards. So they told Jugal Kishore Birla wanted to buy that thing. They said, you just repay the debt that we have and this is yours. So in 1944, the entire Katra Keshav Dev was sold to Jugal Kishore Birla, who created a trust in 1951. The objective of that trust was to create a grand temple for Shri Krishna at Katra Keshav Dev. And among the members of that trust were people like Madan Mohan Malviya. So there is no dispute at all till the creation of the trust by Jugal Kishore Birla. The Patnimal family sold the entire 13.37 acres to Jugal Kishore Birla. He created a trust for that entire 13.37 acres to create a grand Krishna temple.
So it's rather remarkable if, let's say, we compare the story of Mathura with that of Ayodhya. So on the one hand, there is a continuous physical possession of the land.
Yes.
In the hand of Hindus after its first sale in 1815 to Raja Patnimal.
Absolutely.
And second, each British judge, through the entire history of judicial challenge to that possession, has ruled in favor of the Hindu party.
Yes.
Which is not the case in Ayodhya, for instance. So this is rather remarkable about Mathura.
No, in the case of Ayodhya, there is no evidence, I mean, in the sense, epigraphic evidence of that antiquity, as you are saying. But from 1858, when the Faizabad district court began to hear the Hindu and the Muslim party, all the verdicts again went in favor of the temple party.
Okay.
So now we have to come to the twist in the tail.
Yeah, the post-independence twist in the tail. Yes.
Yes. So as you rightly pointed out, it's all very clear till 1951. The trust has been created to build a temple. Now, it's a mystery what happens and why it happens. And I have to confess that my book actually stopped at 1951 with the creation of the trust. I did not know of developments after that until a case just before my book was going to be published. A case was filed by Vishnu Jain in a Mathura court. And that intrigued me. And I got the papers of that case. And when I read through that petition that he had filed, I was really shocked. Now, briefly, what he has said is that Jugal Kishore Birla had created a trust called Shri Krishna Janmabhoomi Trust. Now, he says that in 1968, another body, Shri Krishna Janamsthan Seva Sangh, enters into an agreement with the Idga party and gives 3 acres of Katra Keshav Dev to them. So this is, as you say, twist in the tail. Why was an agreement made when all the cases had been won by the Hindu party? When the revenue records and judicial records substantiated the claims of the Hindu party? When the Idga party had not even won a single case? So why was this? And who's the Seva Sangh and who authorized it to make the deal? What were its compulsions? Seva Sangh has never explained why it did this. So now, according to this case that has been filed by Vishnu Jain, he claims that Katra, the Idga, is built on 3 acres of surrendered land. And according to him, since it is built after 1968, the People's Worship Act of 1991 does not apply to it. Because Places of Worship Act says that the status of building in 1947 will remain the same except in Ayodhya. So he says this Idga is built after 1968. Now, I'm not able to at all answer any of these questions. Why was 3 acres given to them?
The original trust was supplanted by Seva Sangh?
And who authorized? I mean, this cannot be done without great political pressure, according to me.
So, ma'am, you have refused to speculate, I guess, in the book.
Yes.
As to what could be the reasons and what could be political pressures.
Yeah.
But given that you have read the records, brought out by Vishnu Jain,
yes.
Anything there in terms of what was the compulsion of creating another body, supplanting the original trust and then entering into an agreement? What kind of political pressures were in play?
He has given the names of the office bearers of the Seva Sangh. Hmm. And the office bearers include prominent congressmen. Among them, D.P. Mishra, who was the chief minister of Madhya Pradesh. And one South Indian governor of Bihar at that time, but who had also been Congress Rajya Sabha member. But he has given the names of others also. Most of those people are not surviving. So it's very difficult to understand what was their compulsion, because they're not there to, present their side of the story. But I'm sure some people would be there from the Sangh, Seva Sangh, who could offer some explanation, or there would be some records. There should be some records of why the Seva Sangh did it. And because the Seva Sangh has not spoken on this, and this agreement was actually a closely guarded secret. It was not even told to anyone. It came to public light only in 1993 after the demolition of the Babri Masjid. When namaz began to be offered daily at the Idga in Mathura, previously it was offered only twice a year. Then some residents of Mathura went to the court and said, why is namaz being offered every day here and with so much security and all that? Then the UP government said, it then told the court that there has been agreement between the two in 1968. So the mystery remains, the questions remain unanswered, but there must be many documents which can shed light on this. Obviously, if and when the courts begin to hear, because so far they've not even begun the hearings, that adjournment. So if systematic hearings begin, I'm sure many documents will come to light. Only then we will know, because right now we are in a total state of confusion and darkness.
So this original trust, the Krishna Janmabhoomi Trust, which was made by Jugal Kishore Birla, that is in existence, right? So what was the compulsions for them to cede this space to this new body by the name Seva Sangh?
You see, it seems cannot answer this question, but it seems that the trust that was created by Jugal Kishore Birla, it became inactive, maybe because Madan Mohan Malviya had died soon after. And I don't know the reason, but it was not active. So at some stage, this Seva Sangh came. But the Seva, you see, people went to the Mathura court against the Seva Sangh. And the Mathura court told the Seva Sangh, you have no legal existence. There is no trust which shows that you have been founded on this date by whom and what is your mandate. You don't exist legally. You have no right to do anything. This is what the Mathura court had told them twice. But still, the Seva Sangh went ahead and did it. I mean, I don't want to speculate, but some people say that, you know, the government at the center was at that time a minority government, and it needed the support of other political bodies to survive in power. And this could have been part of a deal with other organizations. They would support the central government in return for getting concessions here. Now, how much truth there is to this, I cannot say. You know, because only when the hearings begin, because lots and lots of data is missing. It's being hidden from the view of people deliberately. Whoever has done it would not like to reveal their hand. And most of the participants are dead. But I'm sure that truth can still be unearthed, because there would be documents.
Indeed. And they are parties to the case.
Yes.
So they have to come up in front of the court and present their case.
And Seva Sangh has never offered any explanation. That is the wonderful part of it. They're silent. And I mean, I cannot understand, when the entire premises was with the temple party, what was the compulsion? My only guess is that it could have been a political compulsion, and maybe because of the position of the government at the center, minority position of the government. But still, I cannot say that that's the final statement on this.
Fascinating, fascinating. So I guess something which was not even a dispute actually became a dispute in post-independence period.
Absolutely, absolutely. You put it so well. Put it really well.
So what is next, ma'am, for you? What, your book is out. I guess the verdict is in the hands of courts in terms of where this dispute actually goes. So that is something that we will have to wait.
But I must say that people have given their verdict in my favor. The response to the book has been phenomenal. Yeah, it has really been phenomenal. You know, people have reacted so positively to it. The sales have been good. And the amount of people who invited me to their programs, you know, it is really heartening. That means there is that desire among ordinary people to know, that thirst for knowledge of our past, you know.
And to connect to the past, I guess something which we saw during the recent inauguration of Kashi Corridor, the minister as well.
Yes.
And it was televised, and the outpouring of satisfaction at what happened in Kashi.
It was phenomenal, phenomenal, phenomenal. So, you know, it is that harking back to your tradition, to your heritage, to your culture, to your civilization. These are all manifestations of that, you know.
And works like yours, which you know, retrieves the real history of India, you know, illuminates our past, is something which contributes to that that renaissance that we are seeing.
Thank you, Vivek, for your kind words. Thank you so much.
So what's next for you, ma'am? There is another book coming in. You're working on something next
time. Yeah, a scholar never retires. No? You just go on working. Yeah. So I hope to have something out by the end of next year. I can't tell the subject right now.
Right. Amazing. We would love to have you back to talk about the new book.
Thank you so much.
So this was a fascinating experience. Thank you again for being on the podcast, ma'am.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for inviting me. Thank you so much.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thanks a lot, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Bharat Varta podcast. If you want to see more content like this, then don't forget to subscribe to our channel. We started Bharat Varta to facilitate long-form discussions on politics, policy, and culture. We don't necessarily endorse anything that was said in this episode. If you wish to offer us feedback, do reach out to us on social media. We are at Bharatvarta on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You could also get in touch with us on our website, www.bharatvarta.in. The links are in the description below. Until next time, stay safe, take care, and Jai Hind.